Welcome to History According to Bob, the 20th anniversary shows. Today I'm going to talk about my early interest in history. So this is going to entail probably from my time of birth until about 10, maybe 10, 11. And what I'm going to do, you know, I gave you a list the last time talking about how people come to history, family, genealogy, travel, surroundings, books, movies, teachers, parents, etc., and so on. And so I'm going to work that in just so you can see how it kind of worked for me. Now, one of the things that I've always had is I cannot remember a time when I couldn't read. I know I was reading certainly by four, children's books that my parents had bought for me, and then I had some picture books with animals, and somewhere in the probably from 8, 9, and 10, they bought the World Book Encyclopedia for me. And I loved that. And even though I couldn't read all of it, I could read some, but I looked at the pictures, you know, and I was really interested in stuff like that. So that was always a basis, having books available to me. I was born in January of 1952, so I always make the joke that I was born under the mushroom cloud of the nuclear umbrella, and that as long as they keep flying the B-52, which became put into use in January of 1952, as long as the B-52 is flying, I'll be hanging around. In my childhood, you know, I lived in Baltimore, Maryland. So I'm 6 blocks from Fort McHenry in Baltimore. We lived on what was called Locust Point. And directly across the street was the Latrobe Park. 2 blocks down the street was our church, Our Lady of Good Counsel. And my dad worked at the port for the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, unloading and loading cargo to and from the United States. And my dad had, he was foreman of a gang of people who unloaded and moved them into the railway cars. And did, as a kid, I liked it on Saturday and Sunday because I get to go with him. And he had numbers for certain boxcars, and I got to write the number on the boxcar so that they could put the things together. So I was interested in trains. He ultimately worked for the Baltimore and Ohio for 35 years. My grandfather Packett worked for 50 years and actually had the Golden Pass where you could go anywhere on the planet. And so, you know, we have that in the area, being 6 blocks from Fort McHenry, Independence Day, 4th of July, and Defenders Day, when the British are stopped at a siege of Baltimore Harbor there at Fort McHenry, are always quite memorable. And then when I went to school, first grade, and I still have the book, it's a little pamphlet, quite frankly, but we studied Maryland history. The founders and Lord Baltimore and all of that stuff that went in there. So we had a really strong background in history. But of course, I'm only an hour away or less than an hour away from Washington, D.C., an hour away from Philadelphia. And so we could take the trains and go to those places. Never went to New York or up into the New England area. But we went to Philadelphia a couple of times. We've been to Washington, D.C. several times, particularly the last 2 years that we were there. Because I wanted to see the Hope Diamond and dinosaurs and some other stuff. And so that was extremely important. Now, when we moved to southern Missouri, to a town called West Plains. And, you know, those people lived in southern Missouri. And, you know, you had to drive 3 hours to get to Springfield, Missouri to find something, or same distance down to Jonesboro in Arkansas. But you could go to the lakes and you go fishing and do all sorts of other stuff that really was kind of difficult to do in Baltimore type of environment. You had to be careful, you know, I had a limit to where I could go and what have you. So as I was growing up, I was always interested in a variety of things. Now, when the space program started, I wanted to be, as I said, a spaceman. And I can remember the night Sputnik was launched. Because they rang the church bells in the town in Baltimore. We went out on the street and everybody was looking up in the sky and it was kind of like a little panic. And I asked my mother what was going on, and she said, well, the Russians have put a satellite up in the space and we don't know what it's going to do. So, you know, the bad Russians at that time haven't improved much, have they? And so that always stuck in my mind, and I was always fascinated when I found out that the basketball size Sputnik with 4 antennas, all it did was go beep, 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 beep. It didn't do anything. But the Russians were the first to put it up. So I was always interested in the space program. I remember when they landed on the moon and did all of that stuff. So that was always important. The other thing was I loved watching military stuff. Now, in the 50s, they had a show on, usually on in our area, at early in the morning before you went to church, The Big Picture. And it was kind of a newsreel view of what was going on in the world. So I would watch that to see the new type of jets and all the other stuff. But at the same time, I'm kind of absorbing some military stuff that will come in later on. And I had some puzzles with different types of fighter planes. And of course, you have toys and all sorts of other things that go with that. And of course, every year we traveled. We always went to once a year to either Topeka to see my Aunt Mary and Uncle Rich and all of her family. Or we would also then go out to Hayes, Kansas and visit Grandpa Huff and Grandma. Although Grandma died when I was 4. But I remember going out and seeing Grandpa. Now, my dad and him did not get along, but that's not for at this point. So we'd travel on the train, and my dad would, as we went through different areas, would explain what we were seeing. We kept track of the names of the rivers that we were crossing. So my idea of what geography was like was quite interesting. And then when we got to Topeka, Uncle Rich ran an antique store in my early years, actually till probably I was 9 or 10. And one of the things that he did is he had a shed in the back of the house, which was overflow books. And he would let me go in there, and he said I could have any book that I wanted in there as long as it wasn't his National Geographics, because he had a complete set of them. So I would spend hours wandering around. They'd have to come out and check, see how it was all right. And I remember picking up one book, beautiful marbled pages, and brought it in, and I said, could I have this? And he said, well, yes, you can, but you see, that's volume 3. You can only have it if you take all 3 volumes. So I took all 3 volumes. It happens to be Yonge's History of the British Navy. It was published in 1865. And I've used that forever in teaching all the wars, naval wars with Britain and the United States and France and all that kind of stuff. They still are in a place of honor. And every so often he would find something and we'd be visiting and he'd say, here, I think you'd like this. And it was a book on the dedication of the Washington Monument. And it was a book that was given to all the senators and all of the House of Representatives and just them. And so I had that. So he would always have that. And one year he found they had on display a gladiator helmet, an authentic gladiator helmet, a Reteris gladiator. And so he brought it home and said, you need to have a picture with this. And so they took a picture of me holding it and a picture of me wearing it. My dad didn't take the pictures. A member of the family took the picture, and we've never been able to find that. And I was just, wow, a Roman helmet. And you go, well, how in the world is a little kid running the Rome? Well, you know, 1959, Ben-Hur came out. And I saw it when it premiered in Baltimore. And I was just gaga over it. And for a long period of time, my favorite area of history was actually Roman history. And I liked it so much that I took my World Book Encyclopedia, and went to my dad's typewriter, because it had a ribbon that had red ink, and I typed all the emperors from Augustus through to Commodus. And I stopped there, and my dad said, why didn't you stop there? And I said, because after Commodus, they're all terrible, until you get to Constantine. And I can still remember the look on his face, like, how in the world do you know that? Well, I read it in the encyclopedia. And I have master sets of notes that I used for years for teaching, which I still have. And I just can't get myself to throw them out. And I have those 2 pages with that in the set of notes. I would always show that in class and say, you can get started on this pretty early. But travel was something. We went out 2 years to my Uncle Joe, who was my hero. He lived in Provo, Utah. He was a engineer, did steel work, did all kinds of things. Was at one point he became the president of the Knights of Columbus in the United States. And I loved his son. I called him Uncle Mike, because Uncle Mike, when I was little, was playing college baseball. And ultimately he was offered the opportunity to play for the Pittsburgh Pirates, but instead he went on and into the Boy Scouts and ran through that whole organization. But he had trophies. I was fascinated. I always wanted to have a trophy like Uncle Mike. But Uncle Joe took me everywhere. He wanted to take me to Disneyland, but my mother wouldn't let him. And, well, I'm afraid you'll crash, you know, so they never could get to Disneyland. But he knew I was interested in dinosaurs, so we went to all the places that had dinosaur bones. He took us to different museums. We went to a rodeo, anything. We went, first time I'd ever gone fishing, caught a fish right away. Never take a newbie child out fishing. They'll beat you every day. And he thought, well, do you like music? And I said, I don't know. So he took us all to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and organ recital. And I loved it so much that we had to go back a second time. And when we got ready to leave, I had seen a stuffed animal at one of the toy stores, but it was really gigantic. And my dad said it was too big to take back. We go to the train station, and Uncle Joe has that. And I nicknamed it Uncle Mike. I still have Uncle Mike. He's downstairs in a cedar chest protecting him because I had him all the time. But as we would do these trips, you learned about different pieces of geography. Little bits of history here, when they had the 150th anniversary of the founding of Kansas. Now, they made stamps. My dad collected stamps. Uncle Rich did that. Uncle Rich had a friend who went to the Yucatan. And he would bring back Mayan artifacts. And so he would talk about the Mayan artifacts. And I think that's where my interest in Latin American history came from. But there were always books. I was always lugging books back in my little suitcase to get back home. And then you'd hear the stories about where the family came from. Because my mother's side of the family were Russian Germans. They had fled the 30 Years' War and gone into Russia as farmers. And then later on, they lost their special privileges that Catherine the Great had given to them, and so they came and settled in the migration out to western Kansas. Only somebody who lived in the Ukraine or in the steppe could see Kansas as paradise. And so there were always the family backgrounds of where they came from. And now my father's side of the family, I found out later, they're there very shortly after the founding of Jamestown, because one of the sea captains was a good friend of Captain John Smith, and when Captain John Smith died, he left his estate to 7 friends, and that included one of the Packets. And so I'll talk about genealogy later, because I've heard stories from my dad. What I could remember as a child was that he always talked about that there were two kinds of Packets. There were the rich Packets and the poor Packets. And we were the poor Packet. And I always, is that real? How does that go? And I found out it was true, but I'll talk about that in the genealogical background, because I didn't start doing serious genealogy work until after I was out of college and teaching and trying to do the Packet family. So I'm collecting books. I'm watching movies. I love Sleeping Beauty. I love Sleeping Beauty as much as I did Ben-Hur. Of course, that's the medieval piece, the prince and the princess and the dragons. And so I was always, as a child, I was drawn to those two genres of history, although I loved dinosaurs. I had one of the first play sets that I had, the Marx Company, M-A-R-X, made play sets. These are boxes that had, you know, hundreds of pieces. They had dinosaurs, they had cavemen, they had caves, they made all sorts of those. And that was my favorite toy. And so there are pictures of me, I think probably about 5, where I've taken some of my dinosaurs and stuck them in the cage where my parakeet was so he could chew on them. I still have most of those dinosaurs, the famous, the ones I'm used to keeping. And when we moved from Baltimore to West Plains, and I was given the choice because we couldn't afford to ship all the stuff, I had two choices. I could take all my comic books, or I could take all my toy soldiers. And I took all my Mark soldiers. But I can't look at a catalog on what comic books were at that time period, because I know I had the first Fantastic Four and the first of Flash. I can remember opening that and seeing, and I had probably 1,000 comics, and I had baseball cards too, and they couldn't come either. So as I'm growing up, I'm getting all these little bits and pieces. And my parents were very, very good at the fact that whatever I was interested in, they would try to help to foster that. And they were really fascinated with the travel, because I knew all the rivers and everything else. There goes to a situation where my sophomore year in college, I'm taking the first American history class with Dr. Melkert. And the first thing he did after he told us the introduction to the course is he gave us a map of the United States with all the rivers on it. and we were supposed to mark 50 of them. And I think it took me 10 minutes to put them all in, and then I got up and handed it in, and he said, you know, you could have at least tried. And I said, Professor, pardon me, but they're all correct. And he looked at it, and we had a good relationship after that. It was really, really interesting, because later on, Professor Melkert needed, he taught these huge classes where he'd have 300 people in. He convinced the college to allow him to have some aides, and they couldn't pay us. So what they did was they created an American history reading class. We'd get 3 hours of credit. In return, we were TAs. And so I taught part of those classes. There would be one day where each of the TAs would teach a unit, and we exchanged papers and stuff like that. So my first real teaching experience was actually teaching sophomores in American history. So my parents and relatives are really important at this time, and travel. And I love two quotes. I'm going to quote Mark Twain, and this one is done frequently, but they shorten it. Mark Twain said, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely. On account of this, it gives you a broad, wholesome, charitable view of men that things cannot." The other one is, the actual quote is, "Travel will make you healthy and wealthy. Travel through the earth to see how Allah originated creation." And there is a version of this where he supposedly, someone had stood up and asked him, "Who is the smartest man?" And he said, "Do you travel?" And the man says, "No." And he says, "Unless you travel, you can never have the true knowledge of the earth." So traveling is extremely important. And Mark Twain has traveled all the time, and many people consider him to be one of the first kind of travel writers. I was at one of the flea markets they have here in Kansas City, and I was walking through it, and I saw a beaten up book. It was leather. I picked it up, and the spine was kind of coming off of it. But when I opened the front page, it was a first edition Mark Twain, and it had the date on it. But Mark Twain's books were not sold by publishers. They were sold by people going door to door. And so it had all of that information. And it was Innocents Abroad, which is one of his most famous books on travel. And of course, I got that when I was probably 30 or something like that. Still have it. It's one of my favorite areas. But, you know, everything that I was interested in, you know, was there in Maryland. There used to be lots of old movies that would be on our television and the black and whites. And I loved all of the sword and sandal movies is what we call them now. And one of them was fascinating. It was on Catherine the Great. And there's a scene in it where at the end, she's riding her horse up the steps as they're overthrowing her husband's government. And I'm sitting at home, well, I'm 30 or 40 at this time, with my wife Ruth Ellen at that time. And this clip comes on, and it's the scene where she rides the horse. And I go, "That's Catherine the Great. That's a really good film." And my wife goes, "How do you know that?" I said, "Well, I saw that when I was 8 or 9. She said, that's incredible. But some of that stuff, it just stayed. Now, in my early years of education, which would be to 10, to the fourth grade, yeah, we had nuns, the Notre Dame nuns and the Sisters of Notre Dame, and they were okay, but I have no real memory of anything spectacular going on except that I was sick. I got the measles, what were called the black measles. Hadn't had a case of them in 90 years. Your gums turn black, your eyes are real sensitive. I was out of school for 3 weeks. Then later, after a couple of weeks after that was gone, I had the mumps. So I missed a lot of school, so I was doing all the work there at the house. Where I really learned about all sorts of different things was when we went to visit my cousin and my Aunt Mabel in Hagerstown. Cousin Alice is the one who then drove us all around. We saw the family cemetery. She took us to Gettysburg. I walked the Gettysburg field with her. She taught me how to bowl. One thing I want to add here is the fact that at Aunt Mabel's dining room, there was a wall of little pictures that you would find that people would have from the late 1800s, early 1900s. And on that wall was a picture of a tombstone on an island with two weeping willows over it. And the outline that they made was the body of a man. And I asked Aunt Mabel what that was. And Cousin Alice said, "Well, that's Napoleon on on the island of St. Helena. And that just, I would always go to see that picture every time we went there and look at it. And I've always claimed that that's where my interest in Napoleon actually began. Now, I've had people tell me that it was all an imagination. There really was no such thing. I'd ask Cousin Alice years later, could I have it? She couldn't find it. But I found the original picture of that in a museum in Italy. And so they actually made these pictures. So you never know what's going to happen. So we have all these little things, and I'm really interested. Everything that I was really interested in was history associated. Parents, I assume, unwittingly probably, were very much Lockeans. John Locke believed that tabula rasa, that you're basically open, and what you can pour into that mind as early as you can is a big deal. And that's the way they function. There was none of this just kind of laying around. You know, you just keep, you know, you're interested in it. Well, let's go to the little museum here, or let's watch this on television, or here's a little book on the subject. And I did the same thing with my kids. At one time, one of the high school teachers, Joyce Stewart, the French teacher, she said, you know, you're turning your children into sideshow entertainment. And I said, what do you mean? She said, they're going to be so educated that they'll just think like, oh my God, where are all these other people from? And but that's just what we do. And we've done that even with our granddaughter. Granddaughter has a very, very rare genetic epilepsy. Initially, when she was diagnosed at about 18 months, I remember being in the hospital room with all the rest of the family and my wife, Sherry, because my first wife died of breast cancer in when she was in her 50s in 2011, after we'd been married for 38 years. And the neurologist comes in and says, well, you know, she's got this rare form of epilepsy. And we go, well, what can we do? And he says, really nothing you can do. She's not going to walk. She's not going to talk. And of course, Sherry teaches psychology, has a master's. My daughter has a master's in psychology. She also teaches it and is a counselor. And I've got a minor in it. So we started asking these questions, and she was like, whoa. Well, yeah, I guess you could try doing this. And I will tell you that we did exactly what I've been talking about here, what my parents did, and that is anything that we saw that she gravitated to, we followed through with it. She could memorize. You could show her a picture, and she could match things like crazy, and she still has that. But she walks. She has a little bit of trouble walking, but she walks without anything. She talks. She has a little bit of a stammer, has trouble pronouncing some letters. She had her a little gymnastics thing this past weekend and won 3 gold medals in it. So she's done a lot better than they told her. So that's kind of what we're doing. And then I usually would stress this in my classes, what's going on. But at the when I was 10 years old, my father had a heart attack and had to retire. And so we moved. I thought we would move from Baltimore to Topeka. But my dad found a place that he thought would be better for us to move. We used to, when we would travel, go through Chicago, we have to go through St. Louis and Kansas City. And we would be in Kansas City and St. Louis, and you'd see all these people with fishing equipment. And my dad thought he would retire and fish. And they said, well, we're going to the Ozarks. It's a great place. Down around West Plains, it's Lake Norfolk and Bull Shoals. And so he wrote the Chamber of Commerce in West Plains, and they sent us all kinds of information, and the food prices were incredible. They were a third or even bigger of a percentage less than what we were paying in Baltimore, and you could rent for $35 to $40 a month. So through this paper, and we wrote to the Chamber of Commerce chairman, Art Gutfire, and he sent us stuff, he helped us, and we found 2 people who had apartments for rent, and one of them they were full and one wasn't, so we rented an apartment sight unseen, and we used to joke, because Baltimore was 90% African American, and we used to joke with Mr. Love, who was the man we rented from, he didn't even think about the fact that we could have been African American. He said, no. It would have been a real surprise, though, if I had come in to meet you at the hotel. So that's how we end up moving to West Plains, which is a completely different environment. So that's just a little bit the early years of kind of getting started. And I used that and built on it over the years. So I'll do another one of these next week if I'm not boring you too much. At any rate, thank you very much.